Tommy Arthur from The Lost Abbey joins me this week to discuss operating and growing a brewery. This is Beersmith Podcast number 196.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 196, and it's late July 2019. Tommy Arthur from The Lost Abbey joins me to discuss operating and growing a brewery. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander. The Brew Commander is the new brew house controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is an innovative, high-quality brew house controller with ultra-high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. Order yours today. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice, honey, as well as Whirlpool hop options. Download your 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. Again, that's beersmith.com. And again, let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Tommy Arthur, co-founder and director of brewing operations at The Lost Abbey. Tommy holds an English degree from Northern Arizona University, but found his passion in brewing working at several breweries at White Labs and then Pizza Port, which eventually led to The Lost Abbey in 2006. He holds dozens of GABF medals in local and regional and World Beer Cup awards. Tommy, always great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's been a long time.
It has. It's been, about a year now, I think, since a year and a half since we had you on last. How have you been doing?
I feel like we've been chasing emails. I apologize for that. It's been a crazy summer.
Well, I think you're a busy guy, right?
I pretend to be. It makes it easier to be a little bit harder to track down.
Well, last time I had you on, we did cover a little bit of the story about how you went from a degree in English to founding Pizza Port or working in Pizza Port and then eventually co-founding Lost Abbey. What are some of the things that have been going on at Lost Abbey in the last 18 months since we last had you on?
So we did a lot of work last spring, January, February, March, to integrate our facilities. We had four buildings that we were doing production under, and we had the opportunity last January to put all of our operations under one roofline. And so we spent January, February, and March moving our cold box and warehousing facilities, and then spent April and May moving all of our barrel aging and sour production. So now we share one roof, about 40,000 square feet total, all of our offices and personnel in one building now. It's been quite a wild ride, and I forget how difficult it is to do things like that.
That's pretty amazing. Have you changed your brewery size or production size as well?
No, actually, we didn't add any new equipment at the production level. The only thing we've done in that time was last April, we added a wild goose canning line to our operations, but our capacity wasn't increased, and we didn't do anything really that was major CapEx. It was mostly about just getting all of the people and equipment and synergies of being under one roofline.
And what are some of the new things you've been doing on the beer side?
Certainly, we're canning a lot more beers than we had considered, and we're getting ready to do some trial pilot batch stuff for new beers in the future. There's talk of potentially some sort of everyday year-round sour beer and a couple of other things that we're looking at. So definitely working towards that sense of what the market's shifting to and what where we can participate in that.
Well, today we wanted to discuss actually operating a brewery and what it's like to run a brewery. So I thought maybe you could give us a brief overview of what's actually involved in running your own brewery.
So let's talk just briefly about what our brewery looks like. We are 13 years into our existence now. We opened our doors, as you mentioned, in 2006. We have a 30-barrel, three-vessel brew house. So mash louder, kettle, and whirlpool. It's steam-fired. And we run anywhere from single batching with 30 barrel fermenters all the way up to six batch tanks, 180 to 210 barrels, wide range of beers. So we do about 35 to 50 different beers per year. And included in that mix is three different brands. So we have our port brewing brands, our Lost Abbey brands, and lately the Hop Concept brands. And in terms of the production, we're doing about 14,000 barrels of beer per year. And at our zenith, or sort of our apex, we were doing just over 15,000. So we've been pretty consistently, a 13 to 15,000 barrel a year brewery for about the last 5 years. Our staff is about 50 people total, including two hospitality centers, tasting room on site and a tasting room, satellite tasting room. So we run a pretty lean staff of brewers and packaging people. We're about 15 in the production that we do.
Mm-hmm. What does the production schedule look like on a weekly basis?
So most of the time we're off on Saturdays and Sundays, although sometimes we do a little bit of Sunday work to prep for the following week, depending upon the brew cycling. Typically 3 to 4 batches per day if we're on a heavy brewing week, or 2 to 3 depending upon what kind of a production schedule we're on right now. Seems to be a little bit lighter right now, so we've been averaging about 2 to 3 brews per day. Morning brew, if we were doing 4 in a day, we'd start at 5 a.m. If we're going to do 2 to 3, we'd probably start at 6 a.m. and finish up around midnight.
Wow. So doing 4 a day on one brewing system, right?
Is that what you're doing? It takes about 22 hours. Yeah, about 22 hours, I think, 21, 22 hours. And that includes cleaning up. We had experimented in the past with a full rolling brewing shift. So, there was three 8-hour shifts that just rolled over. But it's a safety issue. It's just a quality of life issue. And realistically, while you could become a lot more efficient in turning the brewery over, our production demands don't require that or demand that right now. So we're going back to trying to make sure that the quality of life is overstated.
And I assume you're not hauling bags of grain up there all the time. What does your day actually look like as operations manager?
So most mornings I get here at about 7:30. I have a facilities plant manager, Ken Klein, who gets here about 5:30 every day. So he gets here right before the brewers, make sure that everything's in spec in terms of boiler up operational things like that. Brewers usually anywhere from 5:30 to 6 on site, mashing in, getting that first brew going, and then they get going on transfers and things like that. My job is to basically show up and make sure that we've got all the conversations going for the day, and then the conversations for the rest of the week and month in terms of where we're heading. I kind of touch a lot of things and only touch them lightly,
So do you spend a lot of time then on marketing or the business end of things instead?
Yeah, I'm definitely very ingrained in the sales, the marketing, the financial side of stuff right now. Where are sales coming from? What do we need to be working on? I don't spend a lot of time in production meetings because that seems to be fairly established with respect to the sales team, calls out what we're looking for and when they need beers to be delivered. If there is production issues, it's typically related to new recipe development or things along the lines of seasonal barrel-aged beers, one-offs, things like that.
So Tommy, how does the organization as a whole make decisions like what beer to brew, what quantities of beer to brew, those kinds of things?
It used to be a lot easier in our world. A couple of years ago, the rate of sale for most of our beers was a lot higher than today, and we were constantly struggling to keep up with keeping beers in our warehouse and in production cycles. Now, because the pipeline out in the trade has gotten a lot more pressured from just other suppliers, that we have really spent a lot more time keening on the rate of sale and sort of the the metrics that go along with how much to produce and, you know, how much is supposed to be in inventory. And then on any given month, how much beer is going to leave the building. And unfortunately, that part of the business isn't terribly sexy, but at the same time, you know, pouring beer out because you made too much isn't sexy either. So a lot of our internal conversations are, you know, what's the distributor's need and, you know, what does code length look like and how can we maintain the sufficient amount of beer to go out the door at the right time for our shipments.
And of course, that's a pretty hard problem because of the time delay, right? The lag between when you send it to a distributor, they actually sell it, it actually makes it to the shelves, all those things, right?
Yeah, and we're probably looking at, I would think in our world, somewhere between 6 to 8 beers pretty regularly being produced across the 3 brands. So knowing how to kind of just in time the hoppy ones versus some of the other beers, that's, I think the key is, you know, how many things do you have to just in time to kind of hit the palate at the right shipping point so that you have the most amount of days when it finally lands, you know, as it goes across the country.
And you mentioned, as we were talking actually before the show about how competitive the craft beer market is getting. I think there's somewhere on the order of 7,000 breweries now, and I don't know how many in planning, but, you know, a lot of people entering the market right now, right?
Yeah, and we're actually, not only are there a lot of people entering the market or have entered the market, there's also been a real big consolidation with respect to distributorships. You know, 5 years ago, a lot of breweries signed up with distributors, went into territories that maybe they can't support at a high level with field sales reps, you know, feet on the street kind of things, big marketing spends. And so there's a lot of breweries, I think, looking at their distributed beer footprint currently, trying to understand how far from home they can be effective and in what markets they're supposed to be in.
And I mean, you've got a pretty good distribution network, if I recall.
Yeah, we're in about 12 states, I think. And, you know, we get to the East Coast. We're in Massachusetts and Philadelphia, New Jersey. So we do send some beer farther from home. But we're having a lot of conversations with some of those mid-sized distributors that we've been working with, you know, who have taken on a lot of new brands in the last five years. And where, you know, they keep saying local is king. And, you know, this is what we need to be competitive. And a lot of local and king and competitive is price sensitive. And so, you know, the further you go from home, the more actions you know, you're required to sort of present and help assist in growing that brand.
Now, is IPA still dominating the market for the most part?
Yeah, I think everybody knows that there's the word IPA and then there's the what is IPA. You know, we have a lot of beers that sit out in the trade that say the word IPA on them and we're all kind of scratching our head as to what makes it an IPA. But, you know, there is a tremendous amount of IPA being sold. And we're lucky to be in San Diego, which has always been a very hoppy beer town. You know, as craft grew up here, mm-hmm. IPA was the prime driver. And so there's a tremendous amount of it on the shelves here. But that also means that it can be difficult to get new ones to the shelf because there's some very established brands with huge run rates.
Yeah. Well, how do you come up with new ideas for new products, new beers? How do you pull that together?
That's the million-dollar question right now. You know, you see a lot of breweries that are kind of veering off and heading into new territories. I've got a lot of friends that keep talking about the seltzer game, and I've got a lot of friends that, you know, went towards, you know, kettle sours and quick sours and things of the world. You know, the hazy beer phenomenon hasn't really hit San Diego with respect to people getting in lines for beers, but there's certainly a lot of hazy beers in bars and taverns and tap rooms and things like that. So, you know, we've been a little bit shy and reluctant to go down too much of what we call sort of that trendy road. And we're certainly looking at right now the sense of how are we going to participate next year in some of those spaces, because some of them haven't gone away. And at the same time, the consumer seems to be wanting less bitter beer, you know, more interesting beer, and even the shift to kind of a healthy lifestyle stuff as well.
So where do you see craft beer going next, do you think, in terms of styles?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of talk about, you know, where are we going to find innovation? And, you know, if you think about the 40 years, basically, that craft beer has been in the United States, what we've come from and where we might be going. And, you know, we've done a lot of things in 40 years. It's pretty impressive to look at what we started out with and, you know, sort of recreating beers from England and Germany and things like that. And then we got to the forefront of being, you know, one of the most innovative brewing communities, so much so that now the world kind of looks back at what we were doing and really is embracing that sense of American innovation. But, you know, I guess the question that I keep bringing up is what's left to innovate with. And in that regard, you know, are we supposed to be innovating? Are we supposed to be right-sizing the brewery to you know, for the long haul, where basically, you know, innovation is going to come from, you know, great imaginative conversations, but you've got to give yourself the time to have those kinds of conversations.
And how big a role do things like your select or reserve beers or your barrel age, you know, sort of the more exotic beers play in your product lineup?
You know, they're a bigger part of the than they've been in the past. We used to have a much larger sense of them going to market, but now we're doing a lot smaller case totals. We have a beer club that we launched 2 years ago, our Sinners and Saints Beer Club. And that's a space where we really do see a lot of, you know, small case and volume totals. We can make anywhere from 50 to 200 cases of beers and really take some shots at things. We've actually got a beer going into the club right now that's going to be sitting on fresh peaches, nectarines, and a peach tea. We've got a cider barrel-aged beer hybrid that will be out in the fall. We went back to our roots and last fall produced a batch of beer with some Zinfandel grapes. So yes, we're taking more chances and really getting outside of just conventional barrel-aged beer sequencing as we look at that part of our program.
And we mentioned a little bit before the show too, I think you're getting some pressure from non-beer alternatives, you know, cider, kombucha, whatever.
Yeah, we actually have a pretty interesting thing happening in San Diego. There's a lot of hard kombucha being produced, and I don't know if there's a lot of other places around the country where there's much going on, but there seems to be a real health push in that kombucha space, you know, here locally. So I don't think we're necessarily ahead of a national curve as much as there's always been a healthy lifestyle to people that live on the coast, and I feel like that the hard kombuchas of the world, there's a disproportionate amount of it being made here versus other areas, but it's being actively embraced. So I don't think it's going anywhere.
Yeah. But I assume you're getting pressure from cider and other alternative beverages, right?
Yeah, actually the one thing that's starting, I think, to kick in a little bit is there seems to be a resurgence in mead coming around. And, you know, there's always been a lot of great mead that's been commercially available and even at the homebrew, you know, level, but we're definitely seeing a lot of new meaderies opening up, and a lot of hybrid sort of styles, you know, some oak aged things, and people really almost pushing it towards a pure wine direction.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of mead. Enjoy it very much. What does your pilot brewing setup look like, and how do you actually, you know, take a recipe, develop that concept, and then eventually bring it into production?
So we actually don't own a pilot brewery necessarily. We have our 30 barrel system that we do have small batch capacity in terms of single batch tanks, but that's really difficult to be, you know, really difficult to fire off 60 half barrels worth of beer and take large chances. So we've developed a partnership with a small brewery down the street that opened up called Ruler Brewing Company. And Ruler has a 10 barrel system, and we're sort of co-sharing that. They're doing all the brewing for us, but it's allowed us to do some innovative small batch brewing. And we're at the same time probably going to start doing some beer for them back at this facility. So that might even open up more tank space down the street.
Nice. How much effort do you put into things like quality control, quality assurance, those kinds of things?
We've got a lot of time and energy in the quality space. A few years back when we installed our new packaging line, we put in a full Anton PAR sort of measuring device from piercing bottle CO2, dissolved oxygen, full lab setup. We can test, plate, do all the things. So our ability to quality, you know, control and assure our beers, I think for a brewery of our size is pretty high. We've also separated the sour side from our non-sour brewing, so we're able to keep things very well separated, and you know, and that keeps us, you know, from having cross-contamination issues. But as a small brewery, we've always put a lot of quality at the forefront, and I think that you know, we are consistently looking to upgrade any chance we get to add equipment to the lab at in the right space is something I'm very keen on.
Nice. Well, you've been in business for 13 years, which is quite a long time in the craft beer industry. What are some of the changes you've seen, and how have you adapted to take advantage or you know, work through those?
Yeah, I think the most interesting change that's occurred lately is the what, you know, used to be the the sort of the prize of a brewer and greatness was sort of that clarity and foam, right? The notion of a great beer and the hallmark of a great well-made beer was great clarity and great foam stability. And now we're seeing these sort of juicy, hazy things come on market that have no head and have no clarity to them. We joked because we put a centrifuge online last year in February, and I'd wanted a centrifuge for a very long time so that we could make consistently bright and perfect looking beer. Mm-hmm. And nowadays most people don't need a centrifuge because they weigh a lot and don't really do much for making hazy beer. So colloquially in-house, we call it a boat anchor because while we run it, most breweries wouldn't be caught dead running one these days. So, what does it mean to be a 13-year-old brewery? And I think that's the question we're asking ourselves is, how are we going to go from being 13 and not being new to being a 20-year-old brewery and participating in a great way?
Nice. Well, that leads right into my next question, which is how do you sort of make the strategic decisions for the brewery? How do you decide when to grow, what the expansion points are, the key decision points for the long term?
Yeah, I think we're in a good space. We have very low debt relative to our operations. Almost all of our equipment in-house is bolted to the ground and fully paid for. So that gives us some flexibility. It also means that we invested very heavily back when craft was growing at a huge rate, and that's given us an over capacity. We're probably operating only at about 50% of what we could push through the building without really needing any more CapEx or even stainless steel right now. Our bottling line is sufficiently sized. Our canning line, while a little bit undersized currently, we could go to more shifts. Our kegging line is fine, and total capacity in our stainless steel, fermentation land, like I said, we're only about 50%, active there. So we've got a lot of runway if we were to develop something that kind of boomeranged and needed to be scaled pretty quickly.
So, I mean, you're in good shape at the moment, but how did you in the past go through making those big decisions? Because I assume you always weren't running, a large 30-barrel brewery around the clock, right?
No, I think back, when we were kind of, at our peak and we were, kind of making as much beer as we felt needed to be shoved out the door, we were probably at about 80%, in terms of wort production. What the tanks could hold were probably about 80% full. We had a larger reserve of barrels. So we were, even though we weren't, tax paying on all of it, we were moving a lot of beer off into the barrels. And so we might have tax paid on 15,000 barrels one year, but we might have made 19,000 barrels or 20,000 barrels of wort just to fill all the pipeline in terms of sour and non-sour barrels and things. So we made a conscious decision when we had the money in hand to buy the amount of tanks that we felt the building could support. And that meant the glycol, all the infrastructure to do so. So if it turns out that we innovate and we find that all of a sudden we need to make 5,000 more barrels or something because it caught fire, we're in a pretty good spot to just turn the guys loose and keep rolling.
Well, looking back, what are some of the problems, some of the biggest problems you encountered the last 13 years, and how did you work to overcome those?
I think the one that I talk about a lot is that we grew too fast one year. And there's a sustainable level or a sense of what is sustainable. I think the one year we went from 3,500 barrels to 6,000 or something. I mean, we grew at like a 60% clip, and it was just too much. And lots of breweries put a lot of emphasis on how fast they're growing, but it's difficult to maintain the quality of the liquid. It's difficult to be predictable with respect to your systems and things like that. So I would say that the one year that we grew too fast was pretty difficult. And then, we struggled early on with just some, quality control measures. There was a lot of artistry and not a lot of science behind what we were doing. And, there was a point where we said, we've got to get better at measuring and improving. And in order to do that, we need the technology to do so. So we heavily invested in the Anton Par. We heavily invested in a Gehaltometer so we could test oxygen and DO and things like that. And it's been kind of behind the scenes stuff. And I think I'm more proud of the beer we're making today than we've ever been, because I think the quality is higher than, as high as it's ever been. But it's also come at a time when the measure of greatness is not necessarily how stable your beer is, but how sexy it looks in a picture.
There you go. Marketing always triumphs over product, right?
Not always, but you know, at some point marketing controls and the product. But I believe that, I guess as a brewer, I want to believe, and I've always been led to believe that beer will win.
Beer always wins. Yeah. That's good too.
That's the hope, right? That's why we're in this business.
How much time do you spend on the business side of things as opposed to the brewing side? I assume it's quite a bit at this point, right?
Yeah, I haven't. I was joking the other day. I was telling somebody there's a couple of fermenters out in the brewery that I've never hooked up a hose to those tanks. So I don't pretend to be a brewer these days. And I think most of the time if I get near the brewery, they ask me to politely leave so I don't screw something up. But, you know, I'm very involved in the entirety of the business, from, you know, where we're spending the money to where we're, you know, what we're making, and even just the packaging and all the design work. So highly involved. But as I said earlier, I'm trying not to touch everything at such a level that I could be disruptive. Mm. And I'm sure my guys would argue with me that I'm very disruptive. So,
yeah. How did you finance the whole thing? How did you pull out? How did you finance it originally? How did you finance all the growth? Because I mean, you're obviously in good shape now, but I assume at some point you had to do some financing.
So we were pretty lucky when we opened up. We took out about a $600,000 note, and in the first five years, we were able to pay that note off in its entirety. And at that point, we also were generating some cash from our sales, and we started basically self-financing most of our growth. We took on some bank debt in 2013 for the first time, mostly to add some of the quality control stuff, put in a few new tanks. And as we started stacking tanks and tilting up tanks that were much larger, those cost more money, and we weren't able to do it as simplistically with pure cash. But we built the business on a lot of cash, you know, going right back into the company. And we're at a point where our debt service today is less than it was 5 years ago. So I feel pretty good about that in what amounts to be a very difficult economy for beer, for brewing, that, you know, at a minimum, chipping away at what little debt service we have is still a great feeling.
So you said you took out a $600,000 loan up front. How do you approach a bank and get them to give you $600,000? What's involved in that?
So I was really lucky because my partners with their Pizza Port run a business had sort of a good foundation. So we actually borrowed the money through them, and we didn't need to go to a bank to start the company itself. So we were we were able to operate with a note back to Pizza Port, and that allowed us to not have some of the same financing woes and concerns in terms of covenants and sales and things like that. So, you know, we had a very solid business model that, you know, all the money was going to go back to them to pay down that debt service, and we were able to do that relatively easily.
Well, I think you're reaching the state now where you're kind of a mature regional brewery, 13 years you mentioned in business. Where do you see the Lost Abbey going next?
I think that's the million-dollar question. I feel pretty strongly that the Abbey brand, you know, has a great heritage and legacy to it, and people know what it's about. It's a little brewery with a big reputation, as we like to say, and I feel like the flavors of the beer we're making are as impactful as they've ever been. You know, that being said, the market doesn't really like single bottle cork finish things currently, and the market wants what the market wants. So we're looking at our hospitality options, trying to understand how to really reach the consumer closer to home. And I think that we've got our eye on a satellite space in downtown San Diego, which will give us a lot of visibility that we haven't had.
So you're thinking about expanding into a new location, I guess? Is that what you said?
Yeah, we have currently a satellite facility where we can do satellite tasting offsite, and we've done very well by that in terms of brand awareness and creating a real connection to our Lost Abbey brand and our other port brewing and hop concept as well. So we're gonna potentially sign a lease here in the next couple of weeks in the downtown part of San Diego, which is about 45 minutes from here in San Marcos, where we're located, and that'll put us in a spot for the first time, I think, where we'll be able to tell our story to a larger populace of San Diego. I mean, there's clearly a bunch of people in this part of San Diego County who know what we are about and who visit us, but giving us a chance to really connect with that downtown, you know, urban consumer is something that I think will be very, very helpful and impactful for the brand.
What do you think about expanding in the tap room versus expanding into bottling? Obviously, you have a huge bottling operation, but I know there's a lot of breweries that are going the other way.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think we all are trying to understand what what each brewery is supposed to be doing. And there seems to be a sense that, you know, hospitality environments are great for everybody, but I don't purely believe in that. I don't see our operation being able to sustain itself without having a decent amount of beer being distributed. We're just bigger than that in terms of our scope right now. So, you know, small breweries that are, you know, coming online, they're very focused on their over the counter direct to consumer sales. And it's great if you can maintain that. The biggest challenge, I think, with building a business around direct to consumer and over your own counter, you know, what they call your own place, own space, is that, you know, you have to generate new consumers. If you lose any of those people, you're really beholden to, you know, how much you can do on a retail level. And it basically boils down to, you know, how many checks per day and at what average are you going to be operating under. And if you lose 10 people and you had 100 to start, that's a pretty big hit.
Yeah, and obviously the margins are much higher there, but the majority of your business is probably bottled though, right?
Yeah, at this point, bottles and cans in production. I think we're about 55% bottled beer, 45% draft.
So with all the new breweries coming online, do you see an industry shakeout at some point? Are some of the smaller ones going to get, maybe get downsized here?
Yeah, I guess our long-term, you know, thought is what, you know, what is the right size brewery for everybody to be? How do you figure that part out? And then, you know, are you content to open your doors and be a 1500 barrel a year brewery and, you know, get your debt paid off and be successful from there? You know, they always say that if you're not growing, you're going backwards because, you know, you have new costs every year, you have rent increases, you know, minimum wage goes up, you know, healthcare costs, things like that. So, everybody, I think, is trying to find growth, but they're all kind of looking and poking in the same place. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Kind of poking in the same places. And, you know, if we're all using the same consumer or working with the same consumer, how are we going to find more in that regard? And I think everybody wants to really figure out where our consumer, you know, next layer of consumers is going to come from.
Yeah. And but craft beer is still a small portion of the market, isn't it? Right.
Yeah. What are we, 13% total right now?
I don't something know. Something like that. Much, it's fairly small. Yeah. So, I mean, there still is room for growth, I think, against many of the big beer makers potentially.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked briefly about kombucha. We've talked a little bit about seltzer, ciders, things, you know, I wonder where the totality is going to come from, but you know, we're a pretty male oriented, you know, craft heavy right now. And if we can find some of the space where we can bring women and minorities and just a larger group of the populace, you know, into what it is we do, then it should become easy to get to 20%.
Well, I was hoping to get some advice. Do you have any advice for somebody actually looking to make the transition into owning their own brewery at some point?
Yeah, I think my biggest piece of advice these days is understand what you're getting into. And that's pretty simple. Basically, it means that there's plenty of room in this for the hobby brewer and someone who never wants to turn a profit. But this is a business. It's a very, very technically, you know, proficient business with respect to the manufacturing of beer. And then beyond that, there's a lot to be said for all of the regulatory stuff that we have to deal with. So I always caution people that, you know, getting a pretty well put together business plan and a model that works for everybody, you know, is important. And then beyond that, just really understanding what, you know, what you are as a brand, because I think a lot of breweries open up with a label or a name, but never really have a brand or a sense of identity. And it's tough to stand out right now. So I am a big preacher in the, you know, your brand needs to lead the way.
Interesting. Yeah. That was the case for my business. It didn't take off until I actually figured out the marketing piece, not surprisingly, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate because marketing seems to be a negative sentiment, but you know, if you think of marketing as just your story and how well you tell it, then I don't think marketing is a bad thing. I think where the danger in marketing, creeps in is when marketing becomes contrived and it doesn't always hold and align to the brand values and things. So, we work really hard to keep the brand values pretty tight, and make sure that the core of the brand doesn't stray off message.
And I thought I'd give you a minute here at the end to talk about Lost Abbey, the brand, where people can find it, where you're located, all those things that people might want to hear if they want to come visit
you. Yep. So we're located in San Marcos, which is a basic stone's throw from downtown San Diego. So we're about 30, 40 miles north of San Diego, a little bit east. We're along the Hops Highway, what they call the 78 corridor. There's about 30 breweries within 15 miles of us. So you can knock out a bunch in a day if you want. You know, we ship our beer up and down California. We get to Greater Washington, Colorado, a little bit in the Illinois market, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. So, you know, we're out there. Our beer is available. It's not widely distributed, and most of the time we're not in the grocery channel. So if you're looking for Lost Abbey and Port Brewing and Hop Concept beers, go find your finer retailers of the world.
Yeah, you do have you do distribute a number of specialty beers too, which I wanted to point out for people looking for something unique.
Yeah, we've got a wide range of you know, what we call occasion beers. And there's the, you know, what amounts to be a little bit more specialty packaging and things that go to another level. And so we've always been known for beers that people put away in cellar and hold and bring out, you know, on those days that they want to really, you know, treat themselves. And that's what the Lost Abbey, I think, has always been about, is, you know, just an elevated sense of beer and a way to reward yourself.
And I just want to get your closing thoughts after, 13 years at Lost Abbey, but of course you worked at White Labs and Pizza Port well before that, right?
Yeah, I feel like I think I'm 22 plus years in the business. It's a pretty amazing thing. I was lucky enough to travel a couple of weeks back to Argentina with a couple of fairly well-known brewers, Steve Dressler, who used to be the head brewer at Sierra Nevada, Peter Brewcart, who was at New Belgium for so long, Will Myers.
What's Peter doing these days? I haven't been able to find him.
He's got a little project. Yeah, he's got a little project in Colorado called Purpose Brewing, and I think he's just enjoying kind of lurking in the shadows and being Peter. But, you know, we got to go to Argentina, and it was great. Also, Fal Allen from Anderson Valley was on the trip with us. But I was the junior brewer on the trip with 22 years of experience. So it was it's pretty interesting to say that out loud.
Kind of humbling, huh?
It was an amazing trip. And I think that for me, the my want in life is to continue to be in this business as long as it'll have us. And I want to retire being known for being a guy who made great beer. So that's the goal.
Well, Tommy, I really appreciate you coming on the show again today. Thanks for being here.
Anytime.
And again, my guest today was Tommy Arthur. He is founder and director of brewing operations at the Lost Abbey. Thanks again, Tommy. Great to have you on the show.
Cheers. Look forward to coming back.
A big thank you to Tommy Arthur for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also Blickman Engineering with a new Brew Commander. The Brew Commander is a new brew house controller available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is an innovative, high-quality brew house controller with ultra-high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Command your brew day today with the new Brew Commander. Order yours today. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available now for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial from beersmith.com. Again, that's beersmith.com for your free 21-day trial. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.